You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
6 minutes after 10. Thank you so much for staying with us and welcome to the second hour of the show. If you've just joined us, we're going to be asking the question, how do we break the back of poverty in South Africa? Poverty is a menace. It is an inherent indignity if you suffer poverty, and that's quite apart from the other ramifications. Sustainable democracy cannot be built on a foundation where millions of its citizens are living in poverty. It just does not make sense. And so we've got to deal with poverty. And as I said twice now in the first hour of the show, poverty is interesting in the sense that we often talk about poverty and other evils in the same breath without actually disaggregating them and focusing specifically on poverty. We tend to use poverty and inequality, for example, in one sentence as if they are synonyms. But although they are evil cousins, they have slightly different drivers, and they need to be dealt with in ways that are interrelated, but we also need to understand them on their own terms. And perhaps one gap on my show has been that we haven't really focused on poverty. So the lines are going to be open throughout, and I'd like you to call in, share your experiences and your thoughts as well, what poverty is and how we're going to deal with it. And as you listen to my guest, whom I'll introduce in a second as well, you're more than welcome to agree, disagree, and also engage them. 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg, that's our number that you can call, and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. I want to welcome to the show on the line, firstly, Anele Nzimande, who is a former legal researcher at the Center for Applied Legal Studies, who do absolutely amazing work there under the Business and Human Rights Unit, and also a producer for The Big Debate that has done so well for so many years now. Anele, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate your being on the show.
Hi, Fabius. Thank you so much for having me. It's my first time on 702, so I'm quite excited to engage with you and your listeners.
It won't be the last, I can promise you that. Absolutely love your work and very happy to have you in this conversation. And here in the studio, one of your other faves, economic strategist, Tabi Lioka, who does also absolutely amazing work, both in corporate but also from a public economics point of view. Tabi, thank you so much. It's lovely seeing you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Lovely being here.
I'm so glad we could finally make it happen. I specifically wanted to make sure that we get into your diary for this conversation, and I'm very happy that you are here.
It's a pleasure, and I'm glad to be here.
I want to start firstly with what poverty is, and definitions matter because they allow us to measure the nature and the size of the problem, Tabi. But people seem to have different definitions, and sometimes they use the ones that suit them depending on which ideological convictions they have about how big or how small the problem is. If you want to be re-elected, you may have an interest in a definition that helps your case in saying, no, we've eradicated a lot of poverty in this country, Wena, don't be unkind. So can we just start there? Because when the recent stats came out, as someone who's not a specialist in economics and measuring these things, one of the first things that frustrated me as a citizen was just reading about so many different competing definitions of poverty. And you have absolute poverty, relative poverty, and, you know, bad, bad poverty, not so bad poverty. How do we even begin to define it?
Yeah, it is a very difficult one to define. And I'll use the most simple one that that StatsSA uses. So this is quite sobering. Over half of South Africans are living in poverty. And how StatsSA defines poverty is that 30.4 million South Africans are living in poverty. This is in a population of about 55 million people. And living in poverty means those who live who spend less than a month, 1,000 rand a month. So that is poverty. And also, you know, just looking at the statistics, one in three South Africans lived on less than 797 rands per month, and that is extreme poverty.
So how does that work in terms of households? Because that's the other thing that immediately came to mind for me when I first heard that stat. Are we talking about individuals, or are we talking about total income within a particular house?
So this is where it becomes difficult to define, because it is, if it's income in a particular house, then that household is not living in poverty. But if it is a complete, so if one household lives or is reliant on less than 1,000 rand, that is poverty. And if that household is reliant on less than 1,000 rand, is 797, that is extreme poverty. So let's say you have five members of in a household and all five have earn 1,000 rand a month. That is not defined as poverty.
And that's exactly why we need a complicated discussion, isn't it, Anele, around what poverty is? Because our lives are socially very complex. We have relatives we care about very deeply, and sometimes the people who do the economics measuring do not always have little clever algorithms that take the complexity of our lives into account. I want you to speak to our listeners about the incredibly different ways in which we can be poor that sometimes is obscured by stats. I mean, the stats are bad enough as they are. But in fact, poverty is even worse if you think about it from a lived reality point of view.
Definitely, Eusebius. I mean, what I'm getting from Tabby is that poverty is a function of two things. So the first thing being low wages, obviously, or a low salary, and the second being the composition of the household. So how some people can be out of poverty is that you have a small composition of a household. So you have fewer people who are dependent on that person, and we call it income sharing.
Yes.
So you have fewer people who are sharing that income, and that can insulate certain individuals who are doing low wage work from poverty. But then you have individuals who are doing low wage work who are supporting, you know, themselves and extended family. And as the black middle class, we've heard a lot of people coin that black tax. And it is a historical kind of systematic inequality that has been created, where you have an overrepresentation of black people in amongst those who are living under conditions of poverty. Because of the high unemployment rates, you know, as well, you find that we have to support not only ourselves and immediate family, but extended members as well. So I think the economic indicators that we see and the statistics sometimes don't get that granular detail as to,
yes.
And as you said, you know, we need the granular detail so that we can properly diagnose the problem, so that we can solve the problem, because a lot of people who are experiencing poverty in South Africa are employed. So then that kind of tells us that the problem is not just unemployment. In addition to that, you need to have job creation, but also creating jobs that provide people with decent wages, not exploitative wages, not low wages. And I think sometimes when we have a conversation around how do we solve poverty, how do we deal with the desperate conditions that people in South Africa are faced with, we limit it to just job creation, and we don't have a discussion really around the minimum wage and dealing with the fact that the employer-employee relationship is still very skewed in favor of the employer, and economic indicators are skewed in favor of the employer. So, for example, when we speak about economic growth, we'll speak about the growth of the business, we'll speak about GDP, we'll speak about all these economic indicators that don't really speak to the people, you know, how are people faring in that economy
Absolutely.
That is growing?
Absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah.
I want to play you a clip here, and I will translate, or it's been translated rather. I do not understand, Venda. But this is a very useful clip, because if you ask people, are you poor? It's interesting what answers you get. I remember once describing my own upbringing as having been raised in a poor family, in a poor community in Ekhini. And some members of my family were mortally offended, because their idea of poverty were the neighbors down the line in a different part of the colored township where I grew up in. So even how people self-define is quite interesting, and tells you about the complexity around measuring and defining poverty. And if you're listening to this conversation, I wonder whether you can consider yourself to be poor, or a topic we'll get to in a couple of minutes that Anele has already flagged there, being part of the working poor. How would you describe your own conditions in this country. The lines are open. Please be part of this conversation. But let's have a listen to this clip.
Sinalanga ndifitondani Matidze, ndi shuma sa security, ndi hora 4,300, ndi naba na benenda ba maintainer, ndi nando inenda kuipata hayani, and ndi nangwana nenda kumujini sa chikoro vasiti, nga chile dene ya security. For ndweyo ndi senda chile dene ringa na buma, it depending kaba tu benenda bandu ita kutisheni ya one, ori quotation inenda kokono i afford andibugai then enda kono rumela chere dia dzindo ngori vathu vanenda vande kuba wana vava chikompa price ya pasi inenda kokono i afford hapa ndidzura Alexander ati badali rende ndikudzura ka private property asiya mushumo ndi private property enda ri chipinga chana vande chikonyanga kudzuro kane ka malugana na poverty ndingari zvenenda aluisa zvone ndo aluwa richitambura ngamanda ende zvino saizvi ndono pa mbebi ndina vana atinyaki zvenenda sogora ngazvo ndichikwaruwa vana vanga navone vatevedzerenge iyo ndira ndizama nganzira dzote uri vana vanga vakono wana future ivona rao rather than nezvenda aluisa zvone ngori ndikoshuma ati believe zvori ndikawela ka poverty ngori ndiyakono uwana zvitu zvinenda kunyagoita zvone ende muthu asashumiyo hakono afforda namusara kuti kunyaga something hakono zviwana ngori uva asina chelede ende uva awaridi nga chelede namushumo zvino nne ndikwine ara ndikunyaga chitu nawo ndichikobhaleriwa amount yeyo ine yangakono svikelera mara ndiyakono zama something.
Okay, so that was Tondani, and Tondani Madiza's story is fascinating. As a security guard earning 4,300, which is not a lot, but there's a couple of features to the story that I'm going to ask Tabi about, because here you have someone who says, listen, I don't pay for rent, I live on private property, I'm trying to find a cheap quotation even, and this is the language, this is aspirational language, I'm trying to find the cheapest quotation I can afford to send money to the builders for a back home back in Limpopo, and right towards the end, I think was probably the most important and the most interesting part of that conversation between Tondani and my producer Mahao, where Tondani actually says that they do not regard themselves as being poor. I try with all my might, here's a rough version of what they said, to make sure that my children have a good future, but they have to pay varsity fees. I want to be in a better position because when I want something, even though it's expensive, I can try to get it. But I don't believe that I fall into the poverty line because I can do things that I want to do. Now, that for me is quite interesting but also heartbreaking, Tabi, because 4,300 rand is not a lot of cash.
And she has children.
But so many people are destitute in South Africa that someone like Tondani may still think to themselves, in relative terms, I'm better off. But if we go back to the conversation Anele has sparked already, we need a more expansive understanding of poverty, because the United Nations, for example, talks about social exclusion rather than only looking at how much cash comes into my bank account every week or every month. There's a lot of social exclusion, lack of opportunity, lack of flourishing, and an expanded definition of living well that clearly Tondani is experiencing, and still she doesn't think of herself as poor.
That's correct. And, you know, it's quite sad in that, you know, Tondani then also pays taxes. So if you compare South Africa, listening to her story, and if you look at other countries where social services are, you know, great and university and schooling is free because the government pays for it and the standards are good. Actually, Tondani would be in a better position than she is in South Africa. And her wealth per se, so her income would go further than currently. Because she's, you know, in South Africa, she has to pay for healthcare, she has to pay for education for her children. She is, yes, her accommodation is free, but she wants to also build a house in Venda. These are things where if I just listen to what she's saying, I don't think she can afford. It's going to take her a long time to build that house. University, I think, just to register is 900 rands out of her 4,000 rand, or just above 4,000 rand income. So she can't even get a loan from the bank.
Yeah.
Just looking at her income and expenses.
That's right.
So I just feel sorry for people in that position, given that there is, you know, if the state functioned better, she would actually be in a better position than she is now.
And if we had a longer conversation with Tondani, we'd also see what the impact would be of Anele, other things like food inflation, what it does to that 4,300
exactly.
that doesn't always track in terms of its own rise, the real increase in food inflation. And we know, of course, as well, Anele, and you have done a lot of work scribing these conditions. So just talk a little bit to it and then we'll take a break. A big portion of that money will also go to transport.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to this thing around identifying as poor. I mean, I think it's very uncomfortable for anyone to
yes.
claim that word
yes.
and to say that I am, in fact, poor, but it doesn't mean that they do not recognize that the conditions that they're living under are problematic and an assault to their dignity. And I think it's important for us to allow people that room to distance themselves, because when you call yourself poor, that's a process, or that's an act
that's
of blaming.
Yeah. There's a lot of shame around it as well.
Exactly. So I think perhaps it's a challenge to us as well to stop referring to people as the poor, as if it's become their identity. That's who they are. They're this amorphous mass of people, you know, that are just that. And I've read an article where, you know, the writer refers to individuals living under conditions of poverty, because it separates the person from the conditions themselves. But anyway, I just thought that was an interesting point.
That's an incredibly important point. Incredibly important point, particularly in a country where many on the right side of the Gini coefficient, Anele, would like to believe that people are responsible for those conditions they are under. So when you use descriptors that make it their identity, it also re-inscribes the idea that they choose to be that.
That's true.
Yes.
And also the term poverty, the term poverty, if you identify yourself as, or you call yourself as a poor, it actually is defeatist in a way. It's almost like you've given up.
Yeah.
And I don't think many would want to, I don't think she's given up. She hasn't given up. She is, she's
entrepreneurial.
She's entrepreneurial. She's aspirational. For her, she's got goals and ambitions. And being, if she labeled herself poor, it's almost as if, look, I've given up. I've stopped looking for a job. This is my condition.
Absolutely. 24 minutes after 10. Let's take a break there. Sorry, Anele. I know that was meant to be a parenthetical comment. We'll come back to what you wanted to say besides the identity point.
Eusebius is on Twitter at Eusebius.
28 minutes after 10, we are in conversation with economist Thabi Leoka and also former legal researcher and producer Anele Nzimande, and we're talking about poverty. Anele, I wanted you to give your own thoughts, because I know this matters to you, particularly because in the next half of the conversation, we're going to talk about what do we do to break poverty. We have now described it, we have got into the details of the definition, the ways in which we are poor, but one of the things that you have said that really struck with me as I was reading through the preparation from my producer is how important it is to not restrict our understanding of poverty to the absolute basic necessities.
Yeah, definitely. I have the view that poverty goes further than that. So poverty is a deprivation of basic services. But I think also when you are unable to just realize your potential, when you're unable to, like you spoke about, I'm so sorry.
Okay, hold on there. I hope you are okay and safe there, Anele. We'll come back to you in a second. Let's go to Kailami. Sandra, hello.
Hi, Eusebius. I'm involved with financial literacy programs. And one of the things I've come to discover is poverty has such a disheartening narrative, Eusebius. It's not just about affordability, but it's perception on what the situation is like and what people can do. As an example, take the lady that was just talking now. She's only earning 4,300, but because of the advancement of the South African financial banking system, she's able to then probably have a store card, have a credit card, and all of those issues, which means getting into debt becomes such an easy thing at that level as well. So the whole issue then becomes so complicated.
Tabi?
Well, that actually is not the case, because somebody who earns that amount will find it very difficult to get a loan from the bank. The bank will be less willing to lend, and also the bank will look at your risk profile. And if they can see that, look, you are spending more than your income, and there's very little savings, and you don't have assets, the likelihood of you a bank extending a credit to you, or even give you a credit card, is highly unlikely.
Absolutely. 25 minutes before 11. Time flies when you're having fun, even with a very difficult topic like poverty, what it is, how we define it, measure it, how it plays out in the lives of millions of South Africans. And what I want to focus on mostly over the next 20 minutes remaining is what are we actually going to do about it. But let me take some of your calls in the meantime. Julia in Cape Town, welcome.
Hi, CBS. I'm involved, work with an NGO called the Clothing Bank that's involved in poverty alleviation through an enterprise development program, training up women primarily to become self-employed traders. And we use a tool called the Poverty Stoplight Model, because what we realize is that poverty cannot be defined by, you know, a dollar a day. It's not just income. And we actually, this tool, we measure poverty over 50 different indicators, which ranges in themes from income, employment, health and environment, housing and infrastructure, education and culture, organization, motivation. And we get all our beneficiaries to actually self-assess themselves on this, using this tool. Mm. And the fascinating thing about it is, well, a couple of things. One is that we find that some of the women, when they self-assess themselves, they look at certain of their areas and they say, do you know what? I'm not poor. And what that does to their psychology, because I think, you know, I think you've talked about the psychology of poverty, and people feel they have no choices.
Yeah.
And what this tool does is actually provides people with a direct line of sight out of poverty, because they realize, actually, you know what, if I can just shift this one thing, or this indicator, or that indicator, I can do that and set goals for myself. And that it becomes an achievable journey for them to actually, they set their own goals, in terms of steps that they can take to move themselves out of poverty. So,
okay, we're going to go there exactly now, Julia, what those steps are that individuals can take, but also that society can take to try and reduce poverty. And certainly there is a psychological element, but I'm going to come back to your thought in a second. I just want to wrap up, and we've already done it dynamically anyway, Anele, but just to close it, and I want both you and Tabby to comment on this, and then we're going to talk about interventions, and I'm going to come back to Julia. The working poor. There was an interesting tweet that dovetails nicely with this while you were giving your stunning deconstruction of why we shouldn't say people are poor in a way that makes it seem like it is a fixed identity. They've chosen it and we shame them, Anela. And I think that's all great. And someone said on Twitter, but the flip side of it is also that if people self-describe as being part of the working class, it also makes it very easy or easier for those who have much more than them in an unequal society to think, well, all is fine. My domestic worker is part of the working class is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, in some democracies, there's a certain kind of social stature that the working class have, and it is elites that often get lampooned in terms of the social strata. But it is important to recognize, isn't it, Anela, that people can be working and still be working poor. Or in your language, they can be employed and still live under conditions of poverty.
Yes, and the point that I was just trying to make earlier before the sirens went off is that we have to create conditions in South Africa where people are not just getting basic, the basic minimum or the basic, what is it, the basic rights, so housing, access to education, but it needs to be, so it can't just, you don't just provide a person with a classroom, but provide a person with all the comforts that need to allow that person to achieve their capability and to have a sense of well-being. So well-being and capability needs to accompany, I think, all of these basic kind of socioeconomic rights that we want to give to individuals. So you don't want to just give the infrastructure and have the healthcare there, but you also want to have hospitals that have nursing staff that is properly trained, that have nursing staff that is able to treat the patients with the dignity that they deserve and with the respect that they deserve. You want to have schools that are properly protected, that are fenced. You want to have schools. So those things that we don't pay attention to, you want to have schools that have teachers who are available to teach on time during school hours. So that that goes to the capability aspect. It goes to the well-being aspect. So we can't only define our interventions, which I know is the second part of the discussion around infrastructure and putting money and then having the government say, oh, but we've done this and we've built this many schools. But it needs to be functional interventions. You know,
absolutely.
The people who are working in those departments or ministries, are they available to provide adequate and efficient services for the people that actually need them? Because what happens is when you're working poor or however you want to identify it, but there's a particular kind of treatment and a particular kind of bias that accompanies the kind of and the level of service that they receive. So that's also what we need to address, in addition to just giving these basic services that they require. Yeah.
Tell me, let's get into the crux of the economics here and the political economy in particular. I do understand what Julia is saying, but there's also limitations to the psychology analysis when it comes to dealing with structural conditions in society, right?
Yeah.
And I was trying to have a little bit of this conversation yesterday on our Entrepreneur Corner with Clem Center, but it wasn't quite the right space. I think he was brilliant, but I think he missed a skeptical question I was putting to him that I'd come across on Facebook, that entrepreneurship talk, when it is not articulated appropriately, so I'm saying that advisedly, is a little bit like every year when we have these matric stories that say, Tabi got 100% for science despite coming from a village with no lab. The unintended implication of those stories is that while it affirms how entrepreneurial Tabi was, she's never seen a science lab, but she still managed to get 100% in her village in Limpopo. It sends the message that if only you can be goal-directed and you have the right psychology and we put you through the psychology mechanism that we have discovered, then you too can get 100% for science, even if my Angie doesn't give you a textbook. It's a structural issue, though. We shouldn't have to tell people that mindset and goal-directedness is the way out of poverty.
That's correct. You need to give everyone an opportunity to excel. And I think you need to be fair at it. Just because you have, outliers.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that those outliers are outliers because they are excellent. Yes, they are excellent, but then it means that also what happens to everyone else who's not an outlier in the situation, we need to target those and give them the opportunity. And you can look at outliers, let's say in Limpopo. Limpopo is a great example because they're often outliers that come from Mbelui school. And yet, compared to the huge pass rates or the great pass rates you see in more affluent areas or more affluent schools. So that just shows you that if you give people equal opportunity, then more of them will excel versus the outliers that you get. And I think that applies to the broader economy, that if you gave everyone, the opportunity from the good schooling, great opportunity in terms of university and also work, you'll have more people contributing towards growth and more people moving out of what we call poverty than you do currently.
So what do we actually do? What is in the solution space? Because Anela's already pointed to one obvious thing that is not being done well at the moment, which is the provision of basic services in terms of our entitlement, by the way, legally, to the progressive realization of socioeconomic rights. Okay, so we know that our state is falling short there. It is a combination of inefficient and also rotten to the core. Those are my words. You don't have to co-sign. But besides that, where do the other potential areas from a creativity point of view lie where we can begin to think, particularly while waiting for the state to be what it is not?
Yeah, I think what you said is important because not many people know their rights and not many people understand or have read the Constitution. And if they did, then they'd understand that it is their right to have, good education or education, and that it's their right to have housing. And they would demand it then from the state if they understood their rights. But instead, you have, 13.4 people who are reliant on grants. The state is coughing up billions, 150 billions, billion rands towards social grants. You know, what can be done? There's a lot. I think, you know, education is one that we've all spoken about ad nauseum. There is, you mentioned transport costs earlier. I think that spatial dynamics need to be tackled urgently. And that will obviously reduce some of, you know, prices. I think we also need to, instead of paying, I think Anela mentioned this, instead of paying a wage, it should be a living wage. So it should be a wage that will allow, you know, someone to live, to buy food, to be able to educate their children. And I guess all of these things, you mentioned the state earlier, but all of these things need to be governed or monitored by the state so that there is equality in the way that things are distributed. So if the state does not monitor, and we don't, you know, regulations are, it's not, regulating is not often a good word or perceived well, but if you don't regulate in a country like ours, then people will do what they please. So, you know, you will pay your housekeeper less than the minimum or the living wage. You will do whatever it is to ensure that actually someone doesn't give... And I know, don't think you do it intentionally, but by not paying someone a living wage, you're actually you're depriving them.
Yeah. Anela, what Tubby is saying is very important, isn't it? That although in South Africa we're often obsessed with state-centric analysis, that the state has a monopoly on passing laws and enforcing them, including how we define something like a living wage. And I know you're very passionate about that. If you look at all workers, but the most vulnerable in particular, like farm workers, their wage levels are not conducive to getting out of conditions of living of poverty. And the role of the state here, while we don't want to be overly reliant on the state, we can't underestimate its political duty and the legal monopoly it has on intervening.
Definitely. I mean, I think Tabi really kind of hit the nail on the head that there is policy there that is powerful but is being poorly implemented, and you know, we have to hold our leaders to account for that. You have farm workers who are earning, they're supposed to now be earning 150 rand a day, but you know, that's yet to be seen, because we can't control the farmer worker relationship on the farm because there are no clear monitoring mechanisms in place to make sure that that happens. You know, you had a widespread farm workers protest a few years ago where farm workers were demanding to be paid 150 from 79 rand per day, and that meant that they couldn't afford to have three meals a day. And that is the great irony, isn't it, that they are responsible in large measure for the food security of the country. I mean, not all farms are farming food, but some are, and they're responsible for food security, but they're not able to feed themselves. And I think we can't relegate all the responsibility to the state, because I feel very passionately about the fact that we all have a stake in our nation. We all have a stake in building our nation into what we want it to be. If you saw the Fees Must Fall movement, it was a workers and student movement. So there was that strong solidarity amongst the workers and the students to also put to end the exploitative practices that you were seeing in the context of outsourcing in universities. And that's what it's going to take for all members of society to say, my oppression is not just my oppression, right? All oppression is connected. And I think we need to take responsibility as well as citizens in this country to say, I need to stand up for my fellow countrymen, and I need to intervene where I can. So if you work for a mining corporation, you have a comfortable job, what are you doing about the conditions of the miners? You know, I think we really need to be complicit. We really need to stop being complacent. And we also need to have an active role in changing the conditions of all people in this country, because eventually we're all going to suffer. It's not just going to be... and possibly we will be the first to experience, you know, the suffering. Yeah, the middle class.
No, but you see, that last point, Anela, I want to take a break everything that you've said is right. So, womandla for nab. I want to pick up on your last point, because I think beyond your moral analysis, there's actually a very good self-interested economic logic for why the middle class should show solidarity. And Tabi will tell me why she's nodding in agreement.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
The last thing that Anela said, I want you to pick up on, Tabi, because you want to expand on that, how important it is, in addition to the fact that our fate is tied together, and so we have a kind of like social reason why, while putting pressure on the state to do what it should, we should also do our own bit in terms of the spaces that we are located in as the middle class, or maybe as a GM running a company and how you run it. But you wanted to bring in here a very important economic element to it.
Yes, I think that it's these lofty ideals of expecting business to try to correct the status quo is, I don't expect them to do it, because it's not in their interest. And unless you have the government coming in to regulate, it is not in many people's interest, to especially companies' interest, to pay more, or at least that would be their first instinct.
Yes.
But then what I always say to corporate South Africa is that we have, almost 36-37% unemployment rate, if you use the expanded definition. And I always say, look, you're doing well, but with a workforce that is a third of what it really should be. So imagine if unemployment was 10%, how much better you'd be doing.
Yeah.
And imagine how the country would be if the unemployment rate was 10%. In terms of crime, in terms of education level, actually the country would be better.
Why do your friends in high places not get this?
Because currently they're making millions and it's good for them. It's short term.
No, but if I hear you, and maybe I'm hearing you with my lefty ears, right? That's why I'm hearing you so clearly. I'm hearing you saying, Eusebius, it makes capitalist sense to reduce poverty.
It does. But at the same time, remember that in the process of reducing poverty, it slows down the economy, because reform slows down the economy. In that process, it also slows down a company's profitability, because you are in that correction phase. You are either employing people who may not have the skills, and you have to inject a lot of money into upskilling.
It takes leadership with a long view.
It takes a lot of short-term pain. But in the long term, there is sustained growth, not only economically in the country, but also for the company. Who wants to take on that? It is a schlep. Mm. But at the same time, and people look at it, with a short-term view. That right now I'm doing well. Right now I'm earning 8 million rand as a CEO of a mining firm. Why then should I take on the burden of trying to reform the country through paying my workers properly, or also educating or upskilling? There's that argument of, is it my job as corporate, or is it the government's job?
Besides, I pay taxes.
I pay taxes as well. So why am I doing it? Mm. So it's always nice and it's lofty to have these discussions about, social responsibility. But actually, in reality, very little is being done on the ground.
Well, as I often say, and people chuckle at this, maybe it will change the mind of that mining company CEO when they come after his bottles of Chardonnay in the suburbs, then it will get real. Faisal in Centurion.
Hi, good morning, Eusebius. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you, Faisal. How do you see it? What is the solution strategically?
Awesome, thanks. Before we get to business, just thanks and a big shout out for always supporting my friend Caesar. He's done some amazing work, and thank you very much from the supporter side.
Absolutely.
Okay, business time. Eusebius, the first thing is, everything that has been discussed has made a lot of sense. More importantly, in terms of getting the message out, South Africa has a dependency ratio of roughly 10 to 1. That means for every person that's working, he or she supporting 10 people, which is a lot of people. Of course, if you're earning, about 1,000 rand a month or 4,500 rand a month, whatever the case is, right? So one of the things which has come up is getting a livable wage, but you need to create the conditions to achieve a livable wage. And one of the things which probably hasn't been touched on by your esteemed guests is that the situation permeates itself right now, where we have an oversupply of employment into the market. Hence, we have such a high unemployment rate, right? And that, with respect, has an oversupply in the primary and secondary skill level of the market. So we need to, and so we have a structural unemployment problem in South Africa. So our objective really is to change the structure of South African employment.
Yes.
And to do that, we need to upskill our people, right? And like your guest just said now, it's going to take a long-term view and a lot of money.
Yeah.
One of the solutions I propose in a PhD thesis I'm trying to get going is a wealth tax. Because it's easy to take money from in terms of a normal tax, but let's introduce a wealth tax. Let's get the skills that we need in the right areas. Because a transfer of land and increasing wages isn't necessarily going to solve the problem in the long term. We have to create sustainable solutions for the issue, right?
Yeah. Faisal, I'm going to put you back to the producers just because we've run out of time. But I'm deeply fascinated by that research and the hypothesis that you have just given us. And we're going to come back to that. We have run out of time, which is probably to the comfort more of Tabi than Anele, because the last thing I wanted to touch on, Anele, but maybe in the next installment, and we'll make the circle bigger and bring Faisal in as well, I wanted to get Tabi to comment very awkwardly on, while we are hammering the state, what it is that financial institutions, for example, can do to improve access of those living under conditions of poverty to be financed, to accessing money and all the other ingredients that go into potentially getting yourself out of their journey, because they do also have a role to play. However, judging by the Twitter timeline, people were absolutely enthralled by both of you. So I want to thank you, Anele. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for welcoming me. I've been listening to you for years, and I've been so intimidated by the guests you had. So I never thought that I would have my day come. So I'm very excited to have been on the show.
You were absolutely invaluable. So many hits. And that identity point, I promise you, that's just it's just lodged in my brain now. Beautiful point. Thank you, Anele Nzimande, former legal researcher, and an absolutely brilliant and, in brackets, gorgeous Tabi Leoka, economist. Thank you so much for coming in. I know it's very difficult to also talk down the economy and the banks and that kind of thing. So I also want to thank you for your incredible honesty in this particular job. There are very few economists as honest as you.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure being here.